Don't talk to strangers. This week's episode breaks from our usual format. I am sharing with you a conversation that I had with fellow researcher Andy Bertiome. Andy, like myself, has spent several years researching the child murders, and he's one of the few people who knows the case and the players surrounding it inside and out. We're talking about patterns investigators found when looking at the four murders commonly associated with the Oakland County child killer. Today, we're reviewing the NCJRS document that the Child Killer Task Force used to get additional funding for the case. I provided a link to the document in the show notes. If you'd like to follow along, we are reviewing the patterns listed on pages 9 and 10 of this document. Also, we will talk about investigators, prosecutors, suspects. Andy pays a visit to Greg Green's house, and I ask the question, where were the perp walks? Because in 1977, law enforcement were bringing in dozens of men known to prey on children. So why weren't they locked up? Why weren't they taken off the streets? Where were the perp walks?
Where do we want to start?
Well, we talked about the suspect profile.
Yes.
And you sent me that link. Let me open that up.
Yep. It's a big document. I mean, a lot of it's just filler with forms and everything. And so it does give some information about the previous victims, too. Cynthia, yeah. Sheila.
Yep. It doesn't mention Judy.
Interesting.
But Judy, they knew who did it.
Right.
So I understand her being left out. But yeah, let's just jump up to page 9.
Yeah.
Patterns.
Patterns. I'd be really interested to know who created this document.
Right. Have you watched Mindhunter on Netflix?
I read the book, which I really enjoyed. I think the show is really, really well done. Like, it's, to me, it's overdone. It's like, it's so beautiful, the cinematography and everything about it. I've only seen the first couple episodes. I really enjoyed it. I gotta get back into it.
Well, but one of the things that jumped out at me is they're doing this profiling work in what, 74 or 75?
Yep.
The idea of profiling was in its infancy. So what we're seeing here in this, which was created in 77, is really like their best guess, because they haven't refined the work.
Absolutely. So. I know you've spoken to a profiler. The profiler that I've spoken to had said, yeah, it was really in its infancy back in the 70s. They've definitely refined it. But he was actually quite, I think he was impressed. He felt it was quite general, you know, as we'll go through these patterns and everything. I think he was impressed for that era.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, they put a lot of money into this case.
Yep. Page 9.
Yeah, patterns. Do you want me to read the first item or the first paragraph?
Okay. Yeah, that'd be great. If we could just go through it, I think. And if you want to read, we could do the first paragraph and then we'll go number by number.
In their analysis of the four Oakland County murders, the investigating officers noted certain similarities in the crimes that supported the theory that they were interrelated. That is, committed by a single killer or small group of killers.
See, that is interesting to me, that wording, because it's like, so what is it? Is it a single killer or is it a small group of killers, right?
I think that if you look at the four cases that are canon, the two boys, the two girls,
yep,
there's arguments for it being one killer and there's arguments for it being multiple people involved in the abduction and the holding. You know, they abducted them, they held them, they assaulted them, they killed them.
Yeah.
So to me, it's mainly that they were held for so many days that would have me leaning towards more than one person. But if you jump forward to 78, 79, early 80s, they always talked about it being a lone killer, a criminal mastermind, and that they were either dead or institutionalized.
Yep.
So it's interesting to see this here where they're talking about one or more, but then afterward, it was always well, this criminal genius outsmarted us.
Yep. Sophisticated killer, right?
Yeah.
That taunted us with certain things. Yeah. The profiler that I spoke to, kind of referring back to this paragraph, he really was adamant that he just felt it was one person. I have to go back to my notes to see why exactly he felt that way, but he just thought, I think he thought along the lines of what Barry King initially thought back before what Barry King told me was, you know, he just thought that if it was two or more people, someone would eventually spill the beans, right? That it just didn't make sense to him. Now, of course, Barry King has changed his beliefs of as to who did it. He thinks it's most likely a group of procurers of child pornography of some sort, with Christopher Bush being involved. But yeah, I was surprised when the profiler said that to me. Do you remember what your profiler said? Did it was a she, right?
It was a she.
Yep.
And it was her take on it was very much that Gregory Green has done this before. He's clearly done it again. And she's right. I can't argue with that assessment.
Yep.
We know what he did in California with the boy that was on his baseball team.
Yep.
And we talked about Mindhunter, and I'm reading The Cases That Haunt Us, I think is the name of the book. And they're talking about Elizabeth Short, who was the Black Dahlia case. And she was dumped on the side of the road, you know, after she was absolutely, you're familiar with the case, right?
Yep.
Okay. And he said in that book, or they said in the book, that this killer was like, see what I did. And that was why she was left on the road. And then I'm thinking about that assessment in terms of this case. And I'm actually Facebook friends with Mark, and I really want to message him and say, all right, this is what you said about the person who killed Elizabeth Short. Is that what you would also say about the Oakland County child killer?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That's really interesting to me. I don't know. It goes back to what we talked about before in terms of, you know, we can speculate all we want about certain things, right? And we can look at patterns, and we can look at someone like Gregory Green and those psychiatric evaluations and the court record, the police records and everything like that. And Gregory Green, absolutely. The profiler, I created binders for him with each of the main suspects. So I'm looking at them right now. Bush, I mean, Gunnels is not really a suspect, but he may have been involved. Sloan, the fringe suspect, Hastings, Green, Lamborghini, Sloan. And I know they're all not like direct suspects. Some of them may have been involved or had knowledge, like Sloan. But he was really intrigued by Green, really intrigued by Green.
Yeah.
Maybe in this case, and sorry if I'm going a little off topic for a second, but, you know, we don't have all the information, right? So we have a lot of information about Green. I couldn't provide him certain information about some of the other suspects, you know, in terms of the extent. He really wanted to know what the behavior was like, right? Their crimes they committed. What was the abuse like, right? What did the victim say about the abuse? We know that from Green. We don't know that about everybody. And that's hard to present a profiler with that. And he's like,
right.
he just needs more, right? He needs more. Personality. They fit this, you know, this wanted poster in terms of, you know, white male, lived in the area, those types of things. But he needed very, very specific information that sometimes we don't have.
There are things we know about Arch Sloan.
Yep.
You know, he was a longtime rapist, former school bus driver, which still, but when he finally went away, it was because he had violently sexually assaulted a coworker's son.
Yep.
And the boys, the OCCK victims that were male, were violently sexually assaulted.
Yep.
And you can say the same thing about Green. He violently sexually assaulted the boy on his baseball team in California.
Yep.
When you look at Christopher Bush, and I am not defending Christopher Bush, not even a little bit, but if you go back and look at those court records, I know you've done it, I know I've done it, gone to the county, pulled some of this stuff. Bush was not aggressive. He was not, I mean, sure, he was sexually assaulting kids, but he wasn't punching them or being overtly abusive physically.
Right.
So that does not fit him.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at Todd Warzeka, who's one of those outlying suspects, he was further north up closer to Bay City. He ended up killing himself when police were closing in on him for the rape and murder of two boys in the early 70s. Warzeka was violent. He He was a violent predator. Lamborghini? We don't know.
Yeah.
I've never heard enough about what he was up to say either way.
Yeah, there's not much. I went to see his court record, Wayne County, downtown Detroit, and there wasn't much in the court record. There was the names of his victims, but not a lot. The Sloan record had quite a bit more information in it regarding the crime that put him away for life. But Ted Lamborghini is interesting. Ted Lamborghini had always struck me as someone. Some of the detectives I talked to said, you know, they don't necessarily believe that he was the Oakland County child killer, but he certainly had some sort of information that he refused to give out.
And again, with these people that are holding back, what are they afraid of?
I know.
What is Gunnels, Sloan, Lamborghini, what is preventing them from talking?
Yeah. Sloan is already in prison for life. He's known in the media and everything as a convicted pedophile. Lamborghini's in there for life. Like, what else do you have to lose? I know Lamborghini is quite religious. I don't know if Sloan is, but Lamborghini is quite religious. And he made a quote. I think the Free Press quoted him as saying, "God has forgiven me," when he gave his, you know, I don't know, he was able to talk for a second at his trial, but God has forgiven me. So in his mind, that was interesting to me. That was interesting to me how you can, you know, if he did know something, why say, I don't know. It's just really interesting how you could, and again, that goes into the killer's mind, right? Or someone who's done this to children. It's like, how do you live with yourself afterwards, right? There has to be some sort of underlying sociopathy or something like that.
And Lamborghini said that he paid his victims, that he compensated them for the sexual assaults. Yep. And that's
so I think he kind of let
crazy.
Him off. He let himself off the hook a little bit with that.
Right.
In his mind, he's like, well, no, they were paid for this. They willingly took my money and we did whatever we had to do. Again, it's just making it okay in your head, I think, which is classic pedophile behavior from what I understand.
Yes. Yep. Justification.
Yeah.
So let's go back to our patterns.
Yep.
The
yep.
first pattern is that all four victims were alone when they were abducted and they were all taken from business areas in or near parking lots.
Yep. What do you think about that?
Okay. Mark was clearly taken from the Ferndale business area along 9 Mile Road. Jill was riding her bike up Woodward Avenue, which we know is a very busy thoroughfare, lots of stores. Christine in the heart of downtown Berkeley when she disappeared.
I do think, you know, if looking at the behavior of someone who would do something like this, it is interesting that, I mean, the kids were alone, but it does take some element of risk to do this, right? Especially when you think back to Tim King, who was taken, you know, from a public parking lot. And when the area was on high alert, that interests me. You know, so there's ways when we talk about there's this calculated killer, you know, who would never be caught. But then he was taking these, you know, he or then they were taking risks, especially later on in these abductions.
Yes. Taking Tim that night from a very public place was very risky, but they were able to do it.
Yeah.
And there are people who believe they saw the man who kidnapped Tim King. You know, we've got Doug in his car seeing, you know, pulling into the lot in his new vehicle, seeing the car parked against the back wall. We've got a woman who was buying hair color at the pharmacy that night and going out through the rear entrance. And she says she walked past someone. And I can't remember, did she say she walked past someone that matched the description of Chris Bush?
I think so. That's, is that from Judy Coltman's?
Yeah.
I believe it was a male, shaggy beard, husky build. Yeah, much like Chris Bush.
Yeah, that describes Chris Bush. Yeah. But if you look, Tim was taken on a Wednesday and Mark was taken on a Sunday. So there's not a pattern gender specific with the kidnappings. Item 3 is a statement of fact. I don't know what it tells us. The victims were held captive for periods ranging from 3 to 19 days.
Yeah.
Chris Mihalik being the outlier. What the hell did they do with her for almost 3 weeks?
And that's where we spoke about earlier, where you think that there may have been more than one person involved to hold the child for that long and watch them at all times, right? How would you do something like that unless they were in some sort of imprisonment? Otherwise, you would need maybe 2 people. That goes back to actually what Chris Bush, I think, had told police about him and Gregory Green had a plan to kidnap a boy and one would get a day job and one would get a night job. And they would take turns watching the kid in captivity, which is quite chilling to think about. But for someone by themselves to hold a kid captive, especially for 19 days, regardless of if these kids were treated well, you'd have to somehow keep them captive, right?
Right. And the girls did not show, not that I've seen, mm-hmm. the girls did not show signs of being restrained. The boys did. The boys showed signs of physical restraint and signs of sexual abuse. The girls did not. I have also not seen anything that says that there were barbiturates or other drugs that would have sedated them in their system. And I don't know the half-life of barbiturates. You know, did they administer them and then hold them another day so that it would be out of the system? I don't know. That's something for me to look up.
It's funny when you look through the main suspects, and I guess John Hastings is not a main suspect. He's more of a fringe suspect. But some of his, what he allegedly said about wanting to be friends with the children and, you know, becoming friends with them and giving them and satisfying their needs in terms of what they wanted to do. And he got to know Tim King really well. Again, he could just be full of shit. But the only other way, I think, so you have either a killer who, or a group of killers who would have, like, kept the kids captive against their will, or you had this opposite where he befriended these kids before killing them. But again, that goes against what we see with Tim and Mark, who were sexually assaulted. You know, so you don't see this friendly killer you don't see that in your mind when you know that the two male victims were sexually assaulted.
Right. How do you become friends with someone that you're either raping or allowing to be raped?
Yeah.
But if you have disorganized thinking, maybe you do think you're friends with them.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you do think you're being nice to them because you feed them or bring them water.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we think about the victims being held captive, were they held captive in Oakland County? Were they held captive? Another theory is up north somewhere, northern Michigan. You know, would no one, the thing that gets me is that no one has come forward saying they saw something suspicious at a house or, you know, a family member of some sort. It's just so bizarre to me that there's not more information about someone seeing these kids afterwards or
right.
A family member who's kept this dark secret for years or someone on his deathbed. It just really puzzles me that there's not more information about that captivity aspect.
Well, there's two things that I want to bring up. One is that Greg Greene's, I want to say it was his brother, said that Greg had built like a compartment in his room. So there was like a small hidden room inside the greenhouse in Flint and that he kept kids there. Not forcibly, I don't think, but like he'd let kids stay there and that the new owners didn't even know the room was there. Well, if this is true, was it ever searched? Yeah. You know, was it ever forensically examined? I know they waited 30 years to look at the Bush house, which they finally did back in like 08. Did they ever do that to the greenhouse in Flint? The other thing, and I think it was you and I who talked about this, was that Arch Sloan worked at a gas station, a service station. Back then, the gas stations weren't convenience stores. They were full service. You know, you could get your oil changed and all that good stuff there. And that the rumor is, or he called Farmington Hills Police, which was the city he was working in, to say, hey, I'm working late tonight. So if you see lights on, you don't need to check. It's just me. And that was on the night that either Mark or Tim was picked up.
Yep. I believe it was Mark. And that was a rumor. I don't even know where I initially heard that rumor, but I know you and I discussed that. I definitely heard it somewhere. And I'd love to verify that. When I did ask investigators about that rumor, they kind of clammed up a little bit and just said, I can't comment on that. So that was interesting to me. That's really, really suspicious behavior. If someone just calls the police and says, hey, don't, you know, lights are on. Don't come up here.
I want to reach out to Farmington Hills Police and pull the call log from that night because I'm sure they still have it. But is it going to be like everything else I've tried to access in this case where they're like, yeah, we don't have it because the task force scooped it up and it's now sitting in a warehouse somewhere?
Yep.
I spoke with a gentleman, Michigan State Trooper, who was on the task force at one point, and he told me that it's all there. They have a big, like a garage. Warehouse style garage, and you roll up the door and there's just boxes and boxes and a blue Kremlin and Jill's bike and all of this stuff related to the case. And it's just sitting there and it's not digitized. So I would imagine that that call log is somewhere in those files.
You'd think that they would make a copy and then take a copy for themselves, but I don't think that's how that would be in a perfect world.
Right.
I don't know if that's how that works, but I would love to, you and I have spoken about just spending a, just giving us like 24 hours in there just
right.
to be able to see some of the information and, you know what we were looking for, but to see the bike, to see the skateboard and to like pull these call logs, things that these gaps in the information that we're looking for, we know exactly what we were looking for. But again, how organized is it? The other thing I wanted to tell you, Nina, was stop by Gregory Green's former house in Flint.
Really?
It's a predominantly African-American neighborhood now. And I don't think I told you this. What was I coming back from? I think I was coming back from visiting James, or Vince Gunnell's. And I was like, oh man, Flint. I passed through Flint and I said, I knew
Flint's
I had the address.
Terrifying.
It's terrifying.
Yeah,
and I had the address. So I drove through and it got seedier and seedier and a bit more abandoned. And I pulled in front of the house and it looks exactly the same from the photos. And I was like, well, I'm here. I might as well go knock on the side door because the side door was open, but there was the screen and there's mm-hmm. bars and everything, I think. So I went up there and went up to the side door and knocked. And a gentleman, older African-American man, he was like, I don't know, 10 feet away, like in the kitchen upstairs, kind of looking around the corner. And I was like, sir, I didn't even know how to identify myself. I was like, my name's Andy. I'm working on a true crime podcast. And first of all, like he wouldn't know what a podcast is. But anyway, I finally convinced him to come close to the door. And I said, this is going to be a really weird question, but have you noticed any secret rooms in the house? First of all, I said, how long have you lived here? And I think he said something like 20 something years. And I said, have you ever come across any like, you know, attic or a strange a room that was built in or come across? And he's like, no, nothing like that. And he was still a little like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
And his neighbor was watering her flowers and kind of looking up going, who is this guy? You know?
Right.
And I said, yeah, okay. And I kept kind of pressing that point. And I said, do you mind if I take a picture of the house? He's like, no, go ahead. He was really friendly. I think he was just really, you know,
confused.
Going, who is this guy? Yeah, confused.
What?
So I took a picture of the house and I was like really close to saying, okay, well, hey, are you sure? Do you mind if I come and take a look around or something? But
not
I was like, okay,
walls.
I'm out of my element. I don't really know where I am in Flint. I saw, you know, there's bars on all the houses, you know, so I knew it wasn't maybe the safest neighborhood, but I just had to do it. I had to do it. But the house looks exactly the same. Like it's a green, like a lime green color. And I think that was the color that it was. And one of Green's victims, abuse victims, Kenny Bowman, told me about nights sitting there on Greg's porch. So it's like you can envision these things from the past in your head when you go to these places, right? Much like you and I did when we drove by Christopher Bush's house or, you know, the drop sites or the abduction sites. It's just like you picture yourself in 1976 and 1977. But anyway, that was just a little story. But yeah, it was one of those things. This case has a habit of, it's like sprawl. It's like the sprawl of, I don't know.
Yes.
Oakland County. And it just sucks you in.
Because there's always something else to, you know, another stone to uncover.
Yeah. The thing that I want to go back to about the captivity, though, was if this was Greg Green doing this, why bring the kids to Flint? And then why bring them back to
Oakland County?
But it does mirror the you know, kind of what he did with his victim, his abuse victim in California. Right. He brought the victim somewhere. He brought to the hospital, the emergency room, dropped the victim off. But that kind of shows that kind of behavior.
You know, you aren't from this area, but I've given you like the grand tour.
Yep.
And you ended up having to come over to where Tim was left. And Flint is like an hour from Oakland County, you know, on a good day. It's an hour away. So it doesn't make sense unless he is staying down here or he is hanging with somebody down here for him to come down to Oakland County, grab a victim, and then drive back to Flint. The risk in that alone, being pulled over, somebody seeing something, that's a big risk. But then he and Chris Bush were such good friends, and bear with me on this. Chris Bush lived sort of at near ground zero for all of this. He's like 2 miles west of Woodward, right off Maple Road, very close to where Tim disappeared, very close to where Jill disappeared. But how long had he lived in that house? You know, he went to boarding school in Europe. He had been working and living in Alma. How long had he been in Oakland County You know, how well did he know the area? Although Woodward is just, it's just Woodward. And the way Oakland County is gridded out with mile roads running north and then the other streets running east to west, it's not that hard to figure out. So really, I guess Chris Bush could have only lived up here for a year or two and been familiar enough with the area to pull all of this off. But Greg Green, I don't think so.
That reminds me of something, too, the profiler said about an anchor point. So he believes that Mark was abducted close to the killers or the abductors' anchor point. Anchor point can be, he defined it as either a home or a place of work or a place, you know, where there's a close friend or something like that.
Right.
And that kind of puts, I think, Green back into it when, if he was friends with Chris Bush and he spent a lot of time with Chris Bush and that was just the area that they went and cruised, he may have been more familiar with the area than we think.
10 years after these murders occurred, I used to cruise Woodward.
Mm.
So it's, 10, 11, 12 years. But cruising Woodward was just a thing. And in the 70s, it was a really big thing. You would just hop on Woodward, take it south down almost into Detroit, turn around and go up to Pontiac and just cruise. You know, you'd listen to music, you'd be looking for people. It was just a thing to do. So it's possible that they were part of that cruising culture, which was very common for people in their teens and early 20s, which would put Ferndale, even though it's 6 miles south and 2 miles east of where Chris Bush lived, it would be in his comfort zone if he and maybe Greg or another of his friends participated in that.
Was Woodward used as like a thoroughfare as well? Because I know we talked about the construction of the freeways and things like that. Would someone have hopped on Woodward to get to the various suburbs in Oakland County?
Yeah. You can take Woodward all the way to downtown Detroit.
Yeah. Downtown Detroit to Pontiac, right?
Yes.
Is the length
correct
of it. Okay. Yep. So people would definitely use it as a thoroughfare. I mean, I have. I'm just curious to know at the time.
Right. Oh, yeah. And even now.
Yeah.
You absolutely would. And if you look at Greg Green and Christopher Bush as being social outcasts, which I think we can both agree that they were strange. They were not normal people. The sort of, I'm going to put on loud music and cruise Woodward was open to everybody. You know, it was something everybody did, kind of like the way people used to ride up and down Ouellette in the 80s and 90s.
Yes.
So same idea.
Yep.
Same idea.
Yeah.
If we look at item number 4, the victims appear to have been well fed and not subject to weather or other exposure. So we know that someone had them somewhere safe, somewhere warm because it was winter. They were not starved. They were not dehydrated. We know Tim King had a meal of small fowl in his stomach when he was autopsied.
Yeah, that's connected with number 3 in terms of holding them captive and keeping them comfortable. So they were, not subjected to weather or other exposure.
Right. They were
so most likely indoors, right?
Yes. Some, you know, they were kept someplace warm. It was cold. It was Michigan in December, Michigan in February. It's cold. Even when it's not that cold, it's still cold. So this number 5, I'm going to read it. It really bugs me. The wording, I don't like it. The victims were well cared for during their period of captivity, including caring for their normal biological needs. All the bodies were clean, and Tim King's body was described as clinically clean, as in his finger and toenails had been scraped. Now, Mark Stebbins was wearing urine-stained underpants. That's not clean. Tim King's body may have been washed, and his nails were definitely cleaned, or trimmed and then cleaned. And I think it was not to tidy him up, but I think that Tim King fought. And I hope he scratched the shit out of the people that were holding him. But they had to trim his nails to get rid of any biological evidence, even though we're a good 15 years before DNA really starts being a factor.
Yeah. It is interesting to think that, you know, I've read the, it's not the autopsy, but it's the investigation notes about Mark Stebbins, and you know, his clothes had been worn for a long time, right? For his captivity, sweat stains. Yeah. Like you said, I believe urine stains. Yeah. It showed caked with blood, I think maybe on his back collar or something like that.
Yes,
from that wound.
From a head injury. Yeah.
From the head injury, right? On the back of his head there. So again, when you generalize like this, and this was a document made for more funding for the investigation, the majority of people that you talk to about the Oakland County child killer believe these generalities, right? Like they believe that, yeah, all the victims were, well, the babysitter killer, right? They were all exceptionally clean. But it's really interesting to discuss the fine details, right? And kind of set the record straight.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people believe that these bodies were washed and sanitized, and it's simply not true. Their clothes were not laundered. They were grubby. Maybe Tim's nails were trimmed and cleaned, but to say they were well cared for, no, they were being raped. They were not well cared for. I struggle with that one. Number six, all four victims were dressed in their own clothing. And then in parentheses, we have possibly by someone else, just before or after death. And actually, I think we're speaking of Chris Mihalik with her shirt. She would not tuck her pants in and she tied her shirt at the back, which makes me wonder if she was undressed at some point. She wasn't sexually assaulted as far as we know, but maybe she was kept in her underpants to deter her from running away because it's cold. Again,
that's a good point.
Just guessing. Number seven, all four bodies were deposited along roadsides where they would be readily found. Mark was left in a parking lot. We've been to that parking lot based on the description and the changes made to the building. I don't feel like he was left by the roadside. What do you think?
I agree. No. And when they say readily found, I think it sounds to me more like it was just an opportunity for the killer or killers to drop the bodies off quickly. I think Mark was laid up almost, I think, against the brick wall. Yeah.
He was reclining, but he was near the brick wall.
Right. Yeah. So when you say along roadsides, I picture, you know who I picture? I picture Jill Robinson along a roadside.
Yes.
That, to me, that vision of Jill Robinson, that's what that means, along a roadside. But the three others, no. Christine was some distance from the road, I believe, right?
Yeah. And in an indentation, they even talked about that Jerome Wozni, who spotted her, the reason that he spotted her is that he was in a mail truck. And this is the 70s. People are not driving SUVs. They're driving sedans. And he was high enough up that he could see her. And then Tim King, again, along Gill Road, we looked at that ditch. And Gill Road, that was farmland. That was not a heavily traveled area. It just happened. You told me the story of the two guys swerved to hit a cat and ended up catching Timmy in their headlights.
So again, they're generalizing in these documents, but I think that's an important thing to note because, I don't know, like generalizing is not really helpful in this case.
No. Number eight, there was no evidence of sexual molestation of either girl. Both boys showed obvious anal dilation.
Yep.
So in short, the girls were not sexually assaulted from what we can tell, but the boys were repeatedly and violently sexually assaulted.
That's puzzling, again, to me. There's different scenarios that you go through in your head. Were the girls kidnapped because the abductor thought they were boys? It was winter. Chris had just recently got a new haircut. They may have looked like boys. They may have been sexually assaulted in other ways.
Right.
We just don't know, right? And that's the one thing where you just think. It's like, that's why you just want this solved, because you're like, it's hard for me to, these nonsensical things where you just like to know. Like, what exactly? Who did this? Most likely they're dead. But it's like, could you explain this to us? Why only the boys? Of course, the killer obviously showed a sexual interest in the boys because the boys were raped. But why not the girls? And we know that pedophiles tend to go for one sex or another sex. Not always, but most of the time they're either into boys or they're into girls.
And what did they do with Chris Mihalik for 19 days? That's like, that is going to haunt me forever.
Yep.
19 days.
That's a little under 3 weeks, having a little girl that's not yours with everybody looking for this little girl. How do you keep her quiet? And like you said, there's really no signs of struggle physically that they found on Chris or Jill. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I interviewed Debbie Jarvis, Chris's mom,
mm-hmm.
and she talked about the waiting period. And it's hard, right? Because you want good tape. But you also have to realize that she lost her daughter in the worst way possible. So you're like, well, okay, we can leave it at that. You know, when someone says it was horrible, it's like, okay, well, I think we'll move on because I don't really want to have to press someone, you know, to go back to that, those almost 3 weeks and think about what it was like, just wondering what Chris was doing and if she would be returned safely or not.
Yeah. And I think Debbie Jarvis gets to define horrible for us.
Yes. Yeah. It's the most horrible way to lose a child, I think. And it's funny, we, you know, you and I were so into it and we're passionate about this case. And I think, and I do think, for the right reasons, right? We want to see it solved and we want to keep awareness of the case alive, but it sometimes it just hits you when I'm looking at my cork board here, or looking at my timeline or reading some of these things. It's like, oh my God, these were children. These were children from suburbia, right?
I look at my daughter and I look at her friends and I think, you know, but for the grace of God. The last one, I think we both agree with. Apparently, little, if any, force was used in the abductions. No commotions were reported in this regard. We don't know how they kidnapped them. There was talk that they would come up and start chatting with them and then hit them in the throat so that they couldn't scream as they trundled them into the car. But on 9 Mile in Ferndale, I find that really risky.
Yeah.
You know,
I think you mentioned to me about, especially in the 70s, where kids really deferred to authority figures, right? If you presented a badge or you said, your mom's sick, get in the car, I can bring you to her. Or like, kids are more savvy, I think, these days with the stranger danger and everything and the paranoia of parents, probably a lot for good reason. But I keep going back to what the profiler said, but he's like, yeah, it probably wasn't a big deal in terms of what was said to the kids. Yeah, they were smart, savvy kids. Tim King knew that this was going on and he was sat down at the kitchen table and his parents talked to him about getting into a car with strangers. So something must have been said that was convincing, but it probably wouldn't have taken much in that era.
Right.
But that, you know, sitting in that parking lot. So after you and I drove around that day, I went back to take some B-roll of the Hunter Maple Pharmacy, the former Hunter Maple Pharmacy parking lot. And I sat there and the sun went down. Right. So it was around the time and it was kind of like the weather probably that would have been probably maybe a little warmer than it was that spring day, winter day. That was like spring. I just sat there and I looked at and the parking lot hasn't changed much from what I've seen. You know, and there were people and it was like half empty and people were loading their groceries in the car. And I was just like, wow, you know, I try to put myself in Tim's shoes and I try to put myself in the killer's shoes or the lure's shoes and saying, okay, well, how does this dynamic work? Right. When all this is going on and you can still get someone into the car like that. That's what's so devastating to me about Tim King too, is both Barry and his brother, Chris. I know you've talked to Chris a couple times. They've said that's just unbelievable to us that he knew what was going on. He was a savvy kid. He was warned repeatedly, and yet he still got in the car. So that's why sometimes I think about, yeah, maybe there was some force involved to get a savvy, smart kid like that into the car. Let's go back to Mark for a second. I think Mark, a lot of times when these things happen, it's a crime of opportunity initially, from what my understanding is, right? So Mark was walking alone from the Legion Hall on a Sunday afternoon. He was small for his age and you could have been driving by, the killer could have been driving by and thinking, hey, this kid's alone, you know, and maybe a stressor event happened in the killer's life. You know, I'm just thinking out loud here. And that may have been a crime of opportunity. And then they became more calculated because it was almost a year or more than a year after, right, Mark? I can look at my timeline, but Jill happened at least a year after.
No? Mark was in February and Jill was in December.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So less 10 than months.
Yeah, yeah, 10 months. But still a long period of time, right?
Yes.
But
yes.
I don't know. Like, I think about the abduction sites and it's like, was the abductor waiting for kids in these specific sites or was he driving by and seeing these kids? But because from all accounts, it's probably believed that this was a random person. Like this killer wasn't known to these children. Is that safe to say?
Yes and no. We have some weird connections between Tim King and Jill Robinson, but Mark, what about the guys at the American Legion Hall that were at that party? Did they all stay? Like, were they ever all run down?
Mm-hmm.
So I go back and forth because part of me thinks it was this predator or predators got lucky. And there's Mark, and it's sort of a crummy Sunday afternoon, and he's alone. Hey, you want a ride? And maybe the person had a cool car. Maybe the person had a badge. We know that Arch Sloan had a badge from working as a volunteer fireman in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's eerie.
But again, we know from previous conversations, you can throw 100 scenarios at it and all of them seem plausible. There's just not enough information to commit to a scenario.
I agree.
It could have been a thing of opportunity that he was just driving by and he saw the kid and he parked half a block up and waited for him to catch up. Or it could have been that he was at the American Legion Hall and saw Mark leave and thought that was his opportunity. Or he had a badge. I mean, all of it is plausible. And that's what's so frustrating.
I keep looking at the suspect binders that I made, and I look at the last names here. You know, I think about everybody has, like, the case is stacked against any of these guys. You know, we talked about the abduction sites, and we talk about it. Okay, was it a random abduction from the site, or was it planned? And then you think about Chris Bush and Gregory Green and talking to the police and saying, you know, Chris would cruise for young boys at three locations of the first three abduction sites, right?
Right.
And is it a coincidence? You know, because the more I research Bush and then I see these other guys, I don't necessarily lean towards Bush. But it's like, wow, there's some evidence stacked against each and one of these guys.
Right. Or did Bush say that to troll the police?
True.
Because he had, you know, he knew he was a bad guy. He had four charges of criminal sexual misconduct, and he knew he had a good lawyer, and he knew who his daddy was. So was he just saying that, pardon me, to fuck with the cops? We don't know. There's a good argument for it.
There is, you know, and that's where I think some of the families who have read the same documents that we've had, or we have, King family, I think, really thinks Bush is involved. And there's some, again, there's some really interesting evidence, but when you focus all your energy and your scope onto one particular suspect, and that turns out not to be the suspect, then it's, I guess what I'm trying to say is important. It's important to keep an open mind.
Agree. And I think we could make a case for Sloan. I think we could make a case for Green. I think we could make a case for Bush. I'm less certain about making a case for Gunnels, for Lamborghini, for Warzeka, for Lossing, Hastings. I've got my list over here too.
I knew it was close.
You know, Sheldon, people even want to, you know, pin this on Gacy, and it's like, ugh, Arch Sloan. He was a nasty, nasty man, but he liked boys. There was no reason for him to kidnap the girls. Or is there a reason? We don't know. Or Archie, because you guys are pen pals, right?
Oh, jeez. He signed it as Archie, pen pals. But again, it's the nature of this case when it sucks you in and you find yourself at night writing letters to people serving life in prison, right?
Pedophiles.
You're throwing out these kind of things and you're just like, it's like a Hail Mary and there's really nothing in the, I thought I sent you a copy. I'll send you a copy, but they're the masters of generalizing everything, right? Just saying that they're victims. Like, I have nothing to hide. Like, what, I'm in jail. So what? Why are they trying to pin this on me? You know, and there's trust issues with people that are reaching out to them. Cause I know I'm not the only one who's reached out to them to talk. I don't know. Arch Sloan is interesting. They're all interesting. What intrigued me about the case too, and maybe it's a little morbid fascination, but it's like, okay, Oakland County, a lot of these majority of these men lived in and around Oakland County, which is a refuge or a sanctuary thought of as like a suburban sanctuary. And you had all of these men living in this short distance away. These are like really dangerous men. These are the strangers that they told you to be afraid of in those stranger danger public service announcements. Like, these are the strangers. I was always like intrigued by those. I was like, who's the guy with the trench coat on? Or who's the guy with the sunglasses pulling up and trying to pick up kids? It's like, these are the strangers, Nina.
Yeah, here they are.
Like, here they are. These are the people, you know, you should be afraid of for your kids. And there's just so many of them. Like, we know from the documents of these, and you've went deeper than I have with the other suspects. And there's probably 100 more. There's probably 1,000 more.
But what gets me, and it was something I definitely wanted to talk with you about, and that was as good a time as any, where were all the arrests? Why wasn't the Oakland County prosecutor parading all of these? Because there were tons of perverts that weren't the Oakland County child killer. We've both seen the articles. Where was the parade of arrests? It was like, well, you're not the Oakland County child killer. We're going to move on to the next guy. Why weren't these bastards taken off the streets? Like, if they had started doing this in December with Jill and her face being blown off, started rounding up perverts, would it have been different? There were three children murdered that we know of after Jill Robinson was shot in the face on the side of the freeway. There should have been a parade of arrests that sent all of these cockroaches scurrying back into their holes, afraid to touch another kid ever. But there wasn't. And why not?
You hit the nail on the head. It's like, I don't know. you know, I don't know. Was that the way police investigations were conducted back then? Where there was there more secrecy of, you know, if someone was a suspect, did they? I mean, I look back to other examples, and it seems like there was some high profile suspects in any crime. You go back to some of the other, with for lack of a better term, popular cases from the 70s, right, or even the early 80s, and there's been major suspects that came up almost instantaneously. But in this case, you look at the articles, you look at all the different articles, and it's like, oh yeah, no real good suspects. All these suspects have come out after, well, decades after. But Christopher Bush was never really discussed in the media.
No, not at all.
Right?
Right. I mean, he maybe was they brief, said it was a, briefly know, like a, mentioned, but it was for his activities up near Grand Traverse.
Yep.
Same with Greg Greene, same with Gerald Richards. Why weren't these people immediately locked up? They knew somebody was out there killing kids. People say, oh, Chris Bush, you're picking on him. He had 4 counts of criminal sexual misconduct in 4 counties, and he got probation across the board. Why weren't these people being made an example of? Why was Arch Sloan allowed to just continue? He was on the tip sheets. He was a known pervert. He'd done prison time in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. Why was he allowed to walk free? Greg Greene is really the only one that they scooped up and put away. There's no other high profile arrests. There should have been a perp walk every day or every week of one of these perverts. I should probably come up with a better word than pervert, but no, you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, I know.
Where were the perp walks? Where was the making an example of? If the point of the Oakland County Task Force, which went into full effect in January with Chris Mihalik being found, where were the perp walks? Where were the results? They weren't even like, let's trump something up to just keep this guy in jail for 30 days. Nothing.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating.
And not to defend the investigators, but I'm trying to find an out for them. It's like, okay, like there's a lot of puzzling things about the investigation, and you're like, okay, so you had, you know, one of the investigators said, oh yeah, this case is like turning over a rock, right? And finding the underside of that rock, unsavory, you know, dark, dank. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, so you've turned over a lot of perverts.
Right.
What are their names? And it just stops there. And it goes back to the generalization of this case, right? These general facts. So it's like the investigator was interviewed by the media and said, yeah, we're turning up a lot of creeps here. Okay, well, who are they and where do they live? You know,
are they suspects?
What have you asked them? Jack Kalfflesh says they discounted suspects just on the basis of not driving a blue Gremlin.
God,
think about all the people that slip through the cracks if, oh, well, he doesn't drive a Gremlin. So that's a whole nother discussion about the blue Gremlin. I don't know. You look back on these things and it's like, you just shake your head. Because I know there's a lot of investigators who are involved that I've talked to that would give anything to solve these crimes, and they gave it their all. Structurally, it just didn't seem like a good system, this task force. When you have all these tips coming in, there had to be a better way of kind of looking at these tips or following up on certain things. We only know half of it, but it just seems like it was a flawed design from the beginning when you're just discounting suspects on the fact that either they've passed a polygraph, right, or didn't drive a blue Gremlin, or their alibi is checked out, which is like, come on, you're gonna stamp them cleared because their alibi is checked out?
Because they were at work on Saturday, while someone wasn't, was taken.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to the not being arrested.
Yeah.
Not being charged.
Yeah.
They brought in a lot of people. But the decision whether or not they were going to be charged, that resides with the prosecutor. And L. Brooks Patterson was the prosecutor. So he talked a good game. You know, he went into Mark Stebbins' school and told his classmates that I need your help, that if you raise money for a reward, I will match it, that we are all responsible for finding out who did this to our friend. But then he never followed through with charges for anyone. And I don't understand it. If I could have 5 minutes with him, he's never returned any of my calls. Surprise.
Good for you for trying, yeah.
I tried. That's what I would ask him.
Yeah.
Is why weren't people brought up on lesser charges just to get all of the creepers off the streets?
Yep. And then that's where conspiracy theories start too, right?
Yeah.
You think about some of our suspects, especially Chris Bush, mostly Chris Bush, who came from money and a powerful family. You know, was money involved? Was just the family's influence involved? Well, I guess that shows itself when Green gets life in prison and Bush gets parole.
Yeah. Yeah, he's released ROR.
Yeah, but I think, and that's why I think this case has been so intriguing to just random people on the internet too for so many years, because there's just so many questions that people have. The police, the investigators have, they've done themselves a disservice, I think, in some respects, because they haven't given all the information. And it's like, why are you still hiding behind that active investigation term? Really? After all these years, it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked for you. We haven't found out who the killer is. So maybe we should get the public involved more with the power of podcasts, with the power of these, you know, technologies, people that really care, and open it up. But I like how you're asking these hard questions, Nina, because we have to be critical of this. We have to say, what were you guys doing back then?
Right.
What was the process of clearing these individuals? The profiler said, he said, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's the first few suspects are generally connected or responsible in any type of violent crime.
Right. And we know that Arch Sloan and Chris Bush were among the first tips that came in.
Yep.
And they both were free for really, well, Bush was free until he shot himself, and Sloan was free for another 5 years.
So we have these numbers. So we have these patterns here. Okay. So we have certain patterns. Some of them are quite weak. And then we have, on the other hand, there are certain differences that tend to make the interrelationship of the crimes less positive. For example, Jill Robinson was killed along the edge of a highway with a shotgun, a noisy and attention-getting method, while the other three were smothered, probably by holding a hand over their mouths and pinching their nostrils shut. But that is weird. That is weird to me that we've talked about this a million times, Nina, but it's like, okay, was Jill just shot because whoever dropped her off thought she was still alive? Maybe she had been smothered like the others. Or is Jill even connected to these three? Was it a mom's boyfriend or something like that, right? The only thing that connects any of these things are kind of the loose patterns and the fact that mtDNA links the two boys. I'm pretty sure that's...
There was a hair from Gunnell's found on Chris Mihalik's coat.
Yep.
And the location where the hair was found was like he'd thrown her over his shoulder and was carrying her. So the coat would be like, or the hair on the coat would be like on the side. Her being linked to Gunnell's draws a direct line to Christopher Bush and Gregory Green. Right. That's Chris. And then Mark and Tim both had hairs on them. One of those hairs matched a hair found in Arch Sloan's car. And that hair has never been identified. It's never been linked to anyone, which leads Sloan's. Me to, right. It's not Sloan's. We don't know whose it is, which leads me to another podcast in Bear Brook. If you're not familiar with the case, bodies were found in barrels in Bear Brook Park in New Hampshire. And they needed to identify who these remains belonged to. There was an adult woman and some children. And the bodies, due to decomposition. Okay. So due to decomposition, the bodies were in poor condition. They needed to get DNA. They had hair. They had a segment of hair. And they were able to use this rootless segment of hair to get a jet match quality DNA sample. Well, guess what? We have rootless hair in the Oakland County child killer case. So let's use it to get a jet match quality DNA sample. The King family has already said that there is money in the Timothy King Fund that will cover the testing of the hair. And it's just up to the Michigan State Police if they will allow this test to be run. And I don't know if they've heard anything back, but I think this is a really compelling piece of evidence. I think it's a really compelling avenue to pursue. And it really worries me that we have to wait and see if permission will be granted. I feel like they should be like, oh my gosh, yes, let's do this. And that's not what appears to be happening.
That to me is leading to some sort of conclusion in this case. If you can get I guess it's nuclear DNA, right? You're obtaining nuclear DNA from an mtDNA sample. That is, in Bear Brook, correct me if I'm wrong, Nina, they haven't solved though. They managed to obtain this sample, this DNA profile, but they haven't matched it.
Yes, they have matched it. They were able to use this hair to do a jet match to find out who this woman was. They have sort of reversed engineered it to find out who killed her and killed these children and put them in these barrels in New Hampshire and, you know, left them there for all those years. And we're talking about evidence and cases from the 70s. Yep. So it's not like, oh, well, it's new or it's this. And that hair was in putrefied human remains. The hairs that we have in the Oakland County child killer case have been well preserved, well cared for, packaged appropriately, temperature controlled, ideal setting. Mm-hmm. So what are we waiting for?
There's one document that I did see when they did the testing, I think in the mid-2000s, mm-hmm. The testing in Quantico. And there was a document that said, well, you know, in order to do some of this testing, the hairs would be extinguished, if I'm not mistaken. I'm naming that quote, quoting that document specifically, but they said something like that. So I'm like, oh my God, do the hairs exist anymore? You know, like, were they extinguished? And if so, I guess you can't pull a profile from that. That's my fear, right? Do you know what document I'm talking about, Nina?
I do. And okay. I do recall that it was extinguished, but I believe there is still, God help me this case, a pubic hair from either Tim's body that was not his or Tim's nasal cavity.
Okay.
That is still out there.
Yes.
I feel like if you could identify the owner of that, you got a real good idea who's responsible for what happened to that little boy.
Yep. And I think, I mean, what other conclusions can this case come to if it's not for that type of technology, that development in technology? Like Barry King had always said, well, you know, I always thought it would be solved by a deathbed confession. But is that enough, right? Because, you know, someone might
think that still leaves
beans,
doubt.
But what's that?
I think it still leaves doubt.
Yeah.
A deathbed confession still leaves doubt. I want evidence.
Yeah.
I want them to test this, and I don't know. I apparently need to call and yell at someone. I just have to figure out who that is.
I think it's multiple people in this case. I do like the fact that, as difficult as it is, that Kathy King keeps this blog. They're really keeping up with technology and researching and things like that, and going, hey, yeah, there's this technology, and they post about it, and she posts about all these different things. And it's like, wow, right. That's a very noble, like, that's a very brave thing to do, I think, to keep pressure on law enforcement to do this. But again, why not? Like, why wouldn't law enforcement be jumping on this, going, oh my God,
right.
this is the technology we've been waiting for. This is what we've been waiting for. So I don't know if the case has an advocate anymore.
If you have information about any of the suspects or locations discussed in this week's episode, please reach out to the detective in charge of the child killer investigation at 833-784-9425. That's 833-784-9425. You can learn more about this case on our website at dttspodcast.com. You can join the Don't Talk to Strangers discussion group on Facebook or follow our page. Don't Talk to Strangers is a project of Spective Productions. Thanks to Andy Bertiome for his contributions this week. I'm Nina Instead, the writer and voice behind Don't Talk to Strangers. I appreciate you listening, and please, be safe.